pathprojects.com.
I love my path projects. I love putting them on. I love the way they feel. I love the way they act, and they help me run better.
They're comfortable. They're very convenient.
There was a time that if I didn't have my accessory belt where I could put my phone.
Your fanny pack? Is that what you call your fanny pack to be cool, as an accessory belt?
Yes. To put my phone in, I was bummed. I would say, now I've got to carry my phone, or I'm going to go back and get that pack.
If they went to the normal distribution channel, the shorts would be probably around $500 a piece.
Well, but good thing for us, they're not.
They go direct to consumer. So you need to go to pathprojects.com, or you can go to our partner page, link to their website there, and you can get good, high quality, long lasting, high performing, super cool stuff at a reasonable price.
What do you think the markup is for brick and mortar, Scott? $500 for a pair of shorts?
Yeah. I've seen some of those shorts, man. They're too expensive.
They feel like $500, but they don't cost that much. That's pathprojects.com.
Lakey tip of the trail.
Hey, Scott, we've got Sunny Stroer on the line, and you'll want to hear from her because she is an amazing athlete, an endurance athlete that said, hey, I'm tired of living in a cube. I think I'm going to go live on the side of a mountain. And that's what she's done. She holds land speed records all over the globe, and she's won URA 100 in 2018. She is providing us the tip of the trail today.
Well, in my mind, there's really no way to run in the mountains without poles, because if you're using poles, you essentially have four legs instead of two, right? So your balance is way better. You get to take weight off of your knees, which is huge in mountain running, particularly for the stuff that I do. You know, the races and speed records that I partake in between 30 and 45,000 feet of ascent. So, you know, it could be 80,000, 90,000 feet of vert total. If I tried to do that without poles, my knees and my ankles would just be fried before I was even halfway through. So to me, using poles is a complete no-brainer. It makes me so much faster, so much more enduring, and so much stronger.
So Scott,
so now that Sunny has convinced you, you need to try out some Lakey poles. You can get a discount if you go to our partners page, click on the Lakey banner. You can get 20% off if you use the code TRN2019. That's TRN2019. Go to our partners page.
Hey, Sunny, thank you so much. And let's get you back on for a full episode, because I want to hear some of these adventures and some of these stories. I know you have a lot to share.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Thanks, guys.
Hey, thanks.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation.
Hang on. You got to be.
Okay.
Chill out. Okay. Go.
Welcome to this edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
I'm Scott Warren. Today we're doing one of our favorite podcasts. We haven't done this for a while. It's our Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down with the Coaches.
That's right. And we love it. And we really appreciate Matt Lay, Joe Uhan, and Ian Sharman to come on to be our official experts on the topics that we're going to talk about.
And we call them coaches because they are.
And they coach at Charminian. Help me with that.
CharmanUltra.com is where Ian and Matt are. Matt joined the company just this summer, and so he's joined in with Ian. And we just found out that Joe, that Charmin Ultra uses Joe's services as well.
So what kind of things do you do for them over there, Joe?
Well, I should note that since 2016, I started my own company called Ewan Performance.
Yes.
And so in addition to doing physical therapy, a big reason for that launching point is I've been doing running stride analysis and stride coaching probably since 2012 or 2013, and offering that service remotely. So I've been working with Charmin Ultra probably since, at least probably 2016.
Yeah, it's about 3 years, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah. So offering that service primarily to his new clients and just trying to shore up their running efficiency as they start that coaching journey.
Hey, Joe, not to put you on the spot, who has the best form in ultra running today?
Ooh.
I mean, present company excluded. We don't want to.
I mean, obviously.
It's hard to not say Jim Walmsley. I mean, people will nitpick him and say he's too bouncy, but he has the best hip mobility, some of the best posture. And actually, you know what? Jared Hazen at Western States was really impressive too. And it shouldn't come as a surprise that the people that are running the very fastest in the sport right now, especially like true fast speed have the best form. And I think Tim Tolleson is up there too.
And out of interest, how does that compare, would you say, to like the top Kenyans?
It's pretty similar. Yeah, you know, I don't observe as much of the high end kind of road marathon racing as much as I do ultras, but good running mechanics is good running mechanics.
You know, that you may have already answered that question, Joe. I just finished a book called Running to the Edge by a guy named Matthew Fetterman, and he talks about running in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and especially about the shorter distance races and some of the elite runners back then, including Mo. He talks a lot about Mo. Do you think that the shorter, faster racers have better form than us as ultra runners?
I think it almost mandates it. I mean, I think to get to an absolute speed, you just have to have a really good form.
So does that mean that speed work is good for us because it helps us develop good running form?
Speed work is a metric for running mechanics, certainly. And that's how I use it. And I think that how Matt and Ian use it as well. It's strength development, it's neuromuscular development. But if your stride is off, if for whatever reason there's a mobility loss or you're just not moving as efficiently as you normally do, it's going to show up. It's going to be black and white on whatever you're doing, whether that's a mile repeat or a 200 meter sprint. If you're a couple seconds or 10 or 20 seconds off, that's a pretty good indicator that potentially that there's something not quite right with your stride.
Now, don't mention any names here, and this goes to all three coaches, and a head nod is, or a thumbs up or thumbs down, so no one can hear it is fine. Have you ever looked at a runner that does well, maybe standing on a podium, and say, how in the heck do they do that with that gait?
Matt was pretty quick with a thumbs up and a laugh.
I think we could all probably name several people who we would all agree would be like that, and we're amazed they don't get injured as well, which it shows there's a lot of variety that can work.
Yeah.
But there's certain things that are going to be more likely to work.
Great. And so let's explain how this goes down. Scott, thumbs up, thumbs down for those who have joined us since our last one. Maybe they don't know how it works. We have three expert coaches, and we're going to bring up various topics. And the coach that brings we're going to
discuss the topic.
That's right.
And then after the topic is well discussed among the coaches, then they all get a choice to either give thumbs up or thumbs down.
And we get to vote as well. And we have purposefully not looked and researched any of these topics.
Because they're going to try to influence
us. That's right. We have blinded and shielded ourselves from any knowledge on these topics so that we are pure and we don't have a biased opinion.
Exactly. So, and I think a great place to start, or the first topic, is related to this running form that we just talked about. One of the topics that I think Matt brought up before the podcast that we should talk about is, should you specifically work to improve your form? And I guess one of the questions I'll just throw out there just to get our brains thinking
a
little bit
more.
Wasn't
that a question already?
Well, that's the topic.
Okay.
That's the topic.
All right.
I think that, you know, we've been doing this podcast for a long time and we've all read Born to Run and la, 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 la. Can we develop good form by purely just taking off our shoes and going and running with barefoot? Is that the best way to learn good running form?
I think Joe should really start, given that he's definitely the best equipped to answer these questions, even though I brought it up because I think my thinking has changed in the last few years on this. But I'd be curious to see what Joe has to say.
Well, I think if I had to kind of postulate what sort of went wrong with the barefoot running interest over the last decade, it's because barefoot running, just like speed work doesn't create good form. It is a metric of it. And so if you're running barefoot, it because of the lack of cushioning, it mandates efficiency to feel good. And so if you're not quite doing the right thing, it's not going to feel good over time. And so what I saw clinically was I saw a lot of people sort of what I called the barefoot running stride was this sort of overstriding but kind of tiptoe running form. It's like the sort of form that if you're like trying to run really quietly and sneak out of the house, that's what people would do in either barefoot or in the minimal shoes. And that's just not what running form efficiency is. Running efficiency requires that foot to land pretty close to directly underneath the center of mass. And so it became one of these things where people were doing it. And initially it was okay because they were shifting where the stress went. So rather than landing hard on a heel with a straight knee and driving stress into the joint, they were tiptoeing and accumulating a lot of stress in the muscles of the calf, lower leg, foot, and so on. And so there was sort of this delayed onset of running injury that came from that. It just changed it. And so I think that's the biggest issue with that, that it's going to tell you if you're not running well, it's going to give you that feedback. Barefoot running well.
Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah. So I think it's really interesting because it's that feedback component with form that I find super interesting. And I think I've come around on more recently is that we respond to feedback, and barefoot running provides immediate feedback, right? And immediate feedback is the best kind of feedback if we're going to change a movement pattern, right, Joe?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that changing form is indeed possible and, you know, quite important. And I don't know, I was looking at the literature for a recent Ultra Runner article and just seeing that giving people immediate feedback, they could actually change their form in beneficial ways that would then lower the loading of various joints and tissues. So I do think
Matt, that would need to be continuous. So it's not like you just say adjust this and then they forget about it after a few strides, because with barefoot running, for example, every stride is giving you that same feedback and you can see how it's adjusting the whole way. It allows you to not forget about it, basically.
Yeah, it has to be deliberate practice, but surprisingly little from the literature. And I think Joe might have better insights again here from a clinical perspective, but 2 weeks of training on a treadmill with a mirror and people can change their form beneficially if they have the right cues and the right sort of markers to what to look after.
One thing I've always considered, and I'd like to know what you guys think, is that basically the way the body moves is a result of imbalances, differences in tightness and strength. And so the way the foot is landing is more the result of that rather than the thing that you're purposefully trying to do in the first place. So yes, the feedback can help over time to adjust that. But you know, if you go barefoot, it's not like you magically go from bad form to good form, because you're still going to have the natural differences between muscle length, tightness, all that other stuff, which can be changed. And I think what you're saying there, Matt, is that it can be changed through that deliberate practice, but also, from what I've seen from Joe's work, is basically what his stride coaching is aiming to do, is saying, okay, well, these are the changes you need to make. So there's things you can remember while you're running, but also here are the corrective exercises or the tightness you need to deal with, so that then your body can move with that new movement pattern. And that because the body always chooses the path of least resistance. So you're just trying to change that path of least resistance to be more efficient through corrective exercises and other things. Is that a fair thing to say there, Joe?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that there's a chicken egg argument with the idea of efficiency versus strength and mobility that we may get into in a subsequent question. But everything that you guys say, I agree with respect to the feedback needs to be relatively continuous. There needs to be a degree of mindfulness consistently. And if you think about other sports, every other sport does this. Every other sport has a technique coach. Every other sport, every professional sport, baseball has a swing coach and a pitching coach, and golf has a swing coach and all these other techniques based coaches, and they never go away. It's not like they give a lesson and then they're gone for the rest of the season. There is an aspect of mindfulness in how professional athletes move their bodies every day. And while they strive for consistency, every once in a while things get off and there needs to be corrective action. And I've been advocating this professionally and personally for years and years, and I still feel like it's a little bit of an uphill battle in our sport. And in some respects, because running is so deeply personal and because running is like this expression of body language, to change it can be really threatening to people. So I've had to be very careful clinically in terms of making those changes. And I think we coaches need to, anytime we make a change with an athlete, we have to be gradual with it. But just because it's hard, just because people don't want to do it, and just because the research hasn't quite caught up to maybe what we're experiencing, those aren't reasons to not do it.
You know, that's ironic, Joe, that you said that. So people don't do it because it's hard. But we're talking to an audience that does hard things. So why don't they just suck it up and do it?
Well, like stretching. I mean, you sit down and you stretch. And we avoid that, but we'll do hill repeats. What's up with that?
Or we'll just totally emaciate our feet with blisters.
Yeah. So explain that.
Here's another obstacle that, and I really cringe when I see some of the research papers that I'm sure Matt is aware of. You'll have these this research that'll look at running economy, and economy in most research looks at kind of oxygen consumption and these physiological measures. So they'll look at these measures. They'll do a short-term study that says, here's one group that just runs their normal. Here's a group that's told to change their stride. And so over this short window of time, it'll show, oh, the people who changed their stride, they were more efficient, or they were more inefficient. They used too much oxygen. It was just like, the finding was changing your form is too hard. Physiologically, it's not worth it. And, qualitatively.
It's the same as with any sport, that if you know, whether it's a tennis serve or a baseball swing or whatever, that the way you're doing it, again, it's the path of least resistance, the way your muscles want to do it, the way your brain is connecting with the muscles. And so changing that, you go through a period of probably getting worse before the new thing improves. So it would be the same as a change to your stride.
And so neurologically, and a lot of this, I mean, a lot of these physiological markers, if you were to look at heart rate or whatever, a lot of them are neurological driven. And anytime you do anything different, there's going to be an extra neurological load. So when I'm coaching my clients on how to change their running stride, I don't use a metric of necessarily ease. It is, does it look better? And that's a really important one, because they'll feel really weird. They're like, I feel stupid. I feel like I'm overdoing it, because their brain is so used to this pattern X. If you change it to Y, they're like, oh my God, this is like, I feel like an idiot. But then you show them that video and you're like, wow, like I actually look good. I look like a fast runner. So looking different, and then the metrics of decreased aches and pains, decreased stiffness, those are the things, those will immediately change. And last but certainly not least, is they will run faster immediately. If you're doing the right thing, you are redirecting energy that is lost into the ground or into your tissues, and you are turning that into propulsive energy. So they may not like how it feels. And I hear this all the time. They're like, how are you feeling today? Like, oh, it's so hard to run now. And like, I'm like, okay, well, how's pain? Oh, pain's better. And then it's, how fast are you running? Oh, I'm like a minute a mile faster. I'm like, okay, well, these are metrics that you're doing the right thing. And you just have to counsel them and say, okay, and from my experience, it's 1 to 2 months. 1 to 2 months, you'll still have the improvement in aches and pains. You'll still have the fast running, but all of a sudden it's going to click. And what took all of this energy all of a sudden becomes much more effortless.
I would like to make an observation and put Ian's comment and Joe's comment together. And the first with Ian's, that you can't focus on what the foot's doing, because it might be driven by something further north. It might be type hip flexors, or you know, an issue with a hip extensor. So maybe that's why the foot's hitting there. And so I think that's brilliant, to not just focus on the foot, but the internal body holistically. And to Joe's comment, that once you change something to his study, maybe it doesn't measure as efficiently because you have some tight muscles. The path of least resistance, that Ian was talking about. We're just a product of what's tight, so we find the most efficient way as we're running. And then to make a change just with gait only, without stretching those muscles that are tight, you're not gonna have the efficiency, because you're working harder to get things done. Even though it looks mechanically right, you're not right. You need to stretch some muscles, lengthen some things to improve your mechanics so that right form can be more efficient. You just can't plug efficiency in without stretching and creating a well-oiled machine, which is the body. So,
and part of that maybe just those muscles are underused. Yeah. So now you're starting to use them more. So they just take a little bit of time to build up that fitness too.
Good, good.
So I want to just zip back real quick to something that Matt said earlier that maybe, well, it's probably a little bit counterintuitive, but maybe you can change your form in a shorter window of time. I think, Matt, you said, you know, using a treadmill and a mirror, you know, you could do it a lot quicker than maybe what you think, that it's not a 2 year, you know, struggle to get it.
Yeah. Well, I think Joe pointed out, you know, a month to 2 months for his clients to change their stride, and they might not be spending as much time in front of a mirror as some of these research studies have indicated. So yeah, I do think that it's actually quite a bit shorter period of time than I originally thought several years ago. It's something I've definitely changed my mind on.
So real quick, I think that we can, I have a lot more questions on this topic, but let's vote, because it's pretty obvious. and we have to play the game, whether it's obvious or not. We have to play the game. So the thumbs up or thumbs question is, should you specifically work to improve your form? Thumbs up, fellas.
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up across the board.
It's a unanimous.
Yeah, and with them being unanimous, I'm going to choose thumbs up as well, Scott.
So here's my question for coaches. You have a new client that comes in and says, I want you to make me a better runner. Is form where you start? Or do you worry about, you have no aerobic capabilities, or you have no muscle tone.
Your diet is terrible. You don't sleep.
Yeah, your stress level is out of this world. How important in the ranking of all the things that you can work on with a client, how important is form?
I'll maybe jump in on this one, because I know I'm sure Ian and Matt have plenty to say. But when I start with a coaching client, I have between 2 to 3 pillars, and usually like pillar 0, which is really the basement foundation, is being healthy. So making sure that any client comes in and if they do have an injury, that they're healed. But the 2 pillars that I have are mechanical efficiency and metabolic efficiency. And so mechanical efficiency, that is your running stride efficiency. And so if we want to go anywhere if an athlete wants to be able to progress in their fitness and their ability, they need to have a compelling idea of what their efficient stride is. So we start with that. We start with the running stride analysis with each and every client. Not to necessarily overhaul everything, but it's like, what can we do? What seed can we plant today to improve the running mechanical efficiency? And then the other half of that is metabolic efficiency. And almost everything you guys mentioned is worth discussing with that client, whether that's the first thing I go after is having a compelling idea of what your easy pace is. Like, what's a truly aerobic pace? And what's an appropriate metric to monitor that pace so that the stress rest balance with respect to running is established? And then what you guys mentioned too, it's like, do you have good stress rest balance in your personal life and in your work life? And is sleep good? Is nutrition good? And so those 2 things, it's like if you have those 2 pillars, that's the launching point for a lot of success.
I'd agree. I mean, when we start with anyone at Charmin Ultra, we always offer them if they want any nutrition or stride analysis coaching, because that can make dramatic differences. But I always say to them, because it's a trade-off of, do they want to pay for an additional service? Do they, what things have worked for them in the past, that kind of thing. So I always advise that it's a good starting point, but I strongly advise it if they have lots of injuries, and particularly if they're injured at the moment, because it's not just about being faster. It's also about running in a way that is not going to be causing more aches and strains on the body that mean you keep getting injured. The thing that shows that you're most likely to get injured in the future is your past history of injuries. If you've run 10 years and had zero injuries, you've probably got a fairly efficient stride. If you keep getting injured every 3 weeks, you've probably got a very, very... not wrong, that's probably not quite the right way to put it, but you've got things that can be corrected and made a lot better that'll make you faster and healthier as well. So I always advise it at the start, but in particular, if someone comes to me and they tend to get injured a lot.
How about you, Matt?
Yeah, I would just add that I tend to play in my sandbox mostly, and that's more of the physiological metabolic side of things that I work on. But so if a client comes to me and says, I want to overhaul my stride, I say, I'm sorry, I'm not the right person. I'm not the expert. And I'll direct them to somebody like Joe. And I've done that previously with Joe. And so I will start from more of the physiological side and the metabolic side of things. But if they seem to need it, then I'll reach out to the appropriate experts to have them help. Yeah.
And that's the key thing for every element, though. You know, you go to an expert for the things that they know about. Mm-hmm. So that's why we partner with people like Joe and Steph Howe Violet for nutrition, because if you're not an expert at something, you shouldn't be giving advice about it. So it's saying if someone's injured and they need to physically see a PT or they need to go to hospital or something, we're obviously not going to be giving advice on that. It's so common that we'll get an email with someone will send a photo of an injury or something. It's like, I can't help you with that because firstly, I'm not qualified. And secondly, I can't examine you in person. But here are some people you could go to. And if I don't know anyone local for them, I would suggest using the local running club, local running store, local friends who've worked with other PTs, especially people who specialize with runners. All of that makes such a difference. And it's just making sure, like Matt said, you don't play out of your sandbox, but you have a team of people you can always tap into whose skills can make sure that you're helping a runner in every way.
Are you telling me, Ian, I can't send you a picture of an X on my knee with a Sharpie and have you diagnose me accurately?
It hurts here.
Well, you see, it's not unuseful to send me that. Then I'll say, and this is what you need to do about it with someone else. I know exactly what your problem is. Here are the exercises and now you'll be fixed.
Yeah, that's what a good coach does is he says, you came to me for advice. My advice is go to a doctor.
Yeah, basically.
And to your point earlier, Ian, the people that stick around in this sport, your veterans, often have decent form because they couldn't last that long without decent form. And so you look at some of these 20, 30-year runners and say, well, there's some efficiency because you can't stick around that long. You're going to wear yourself out and break down with poor form.
Definitely, yeah.
So can someone change their form? Well, first of all, if I don't have... either Joe's service or Charmin Ultra's service, and I don't know whether I have good form or not. Let's say I'm not getting injured, but I don't know whether I have good form or not. Can I analyze that and improve it on my own? Or is this something where you guys would say, you know what, it's worth the time and the effort and the expense investment in yourself to go get a coach that knows what they're doing?
I think we all agree, definitely go to the expert. Yeah. Surely. Yeah.
Let's go to the next topic, Scott. I'm ready.
Okay, next topic. This one's somewhat related. This is strength or mobility work, which is preferred? So let's define strength and mobility work. Strength, I would say, anywhere from getting in the gym and lifting some weights to maybe some hill repeat, stuff like that, where you're strengthening your core muscles or the muscles that you're using running. Mobility work, I would assume, is stretching.
We should let our coaches define it.
Okay.
Scott, what are we doing to define it? That's not our sandbox. We don't really have a sandbox.
Nor our topic. This was Matt's topic.
Yeah.
Define them, Matt.
I would say strength is more of your traditional resistance type exercises, squats, weight work, and then mobility being stretching, but also more active types of things in terms of leg swings, maybe like hurdle drills, like things like yoga, things that all sort of increase your range of motion of the various muscles.
My apologies to you, Scott. That was pretty close to what you said,
I was almost on target.
I know. Hey, and Ian, and I've seen you do leg swings before getting out there. You were pacing Chris DiNucci out at AR, year, I think, yeah, or RDL or something. And you were out there doing some leg swings. So important warm-up?
Yeah, I mean, it's difference between a warm-up and things that you do in general for just training. So I'd always advise doing some dynamic stretching before you start moving, just to try and engage the muscles and fire them up, get different muscle fibers ready to move and get them a little bit warmer so you're less likely to get injured on the run. Not static stretching, difference being movement-based. So things like a leg swing where you're just moving it back and forth rather than holding like a yoga pose stretch where you're basically putting the muscles to sleep. And the research shows that the static stretching doesn't really help, especially if you're doing it right before running. At other points, more ambiguous. But I would argue those two things are actually kind of an overlap, because when you're doing dynamic stretching, there's an element of strength work in there anyway. That is helping with a bit of stability, strength, and flexibility, as is using free weights in a gym. It's just more resistance. It's a little bit more power-based when you're using a heavier weight. But I would actually put those two things into a similar category. But I would say doing some degree of strength work that is helping with mobility is very useful, usually for about once or maximum about twice a week for runners. Okay. And also having a warm-up that is dynamic stretching based is useful before you start running, so that you're, and that includes, you know, going for a little jog and having high knees and butt kicks and like you'd see anyone doing before almost any type of sport to get their muscles ready to do more intense stuff.
All three of you are coaches and you work with runners. Do you find that when they come to you initially that they're not doing any of this mobility work?
Usually they're not.
The mobility stuff, less so. Strength stuff, it's like 50-50.
Okay. I guess it's easier because there's so many gyms around and people think, well, I got to have big legs if I'm going to run a long, long way. But the reason why I ask you that is I just don't do it.
Which one?
I get out of
busy work life and they go, okay, I've got an hour to fit in my run, so I'm going to do 60 minutes of running and I'm not going to do anything else. I think it's mainly time-based and also maybe just not knowing what would be the most useful thing to help. But even just doing 1 or 2 minutes of a dynamic warm-up can help with that run and just maybe slightly lower the chance of injury. But, I'd say it's mainly time that people think I'm a runner, prioritize running, and at a high level that is fair.
Hey, Joe, can you weigh in on this?
Sure. And I've got a lot to say since I just yesterday found out that I get 4 more letters added to my name because I passed my certification in functional manual therapy. And that is a credentialed certification offered through the American Physical Therapy Association. And it's offered through a group called the Institute of Physical Art. And they're a manual therapy outfit in North America that teaches, as sort of their pillars of just function, are 3 things. Number 1 is mechanical capacity. And number 2 is neuromuscular strength. And then number 3 is motor control. And so this fits really well into this discussion, because when we're asking the question about strength versus mobility, what they teach from a functional standpoint is you have to have mechanical capacity first. And what that means is, as these gentlemen have already alluded to, if you're asking someone to do something and they can't physically move because they don't possess the range of motion, that is a deficit of mechanical capacity. They simply do not have the capacity to move. And I ran into that early in my career as a PT and as a coach. It's like you're trying to get somebody to lift their knees higher. Well, they don't have the hip mobility to do that. So that has to be the starting point. And then the next one, with respect to strength, this gets really interesting clinically. And another thing I ran into as a clinician and a coach is there's a difference between in the umbrella of strength, there is neuromuscular 3 components, really. It is initiation, it is brute strength, and it is endurance. And so this is the hard part. And I'll ask clients this all the time. I'm like, hey, have you ever done an ab workout and not actually felt your abs? And they're like, yeah. Like, they'll do abs, but they'll only feel their hip flexors. And that is an idea of a lack of initiation or an activation problem in the core. So that's especially frustrating if you have an athlete who's trying to do physical activity or strength training and they just can't activate the muscle. And so that's one component. And then putting it all together is you have to have the mobility, then the strength to ultimately be successful at the motor control. And so how I kind of compartmentalize this in the clinic, or at least make these terms more user-friendly, as I say, mobility, strength or stability, and efficiency. And so you have to really kind of go in that order. Get that the capacity to move, then the activation of the muscle, which gets a little bit dicey as to how to do that, and then the efficiency. And where what Ian was talking about, this is the whole point of drills. And I'll tell my athletes, the reason we do drills is they are an exaggeration of the ideal. So if you're trying to do high knees as part of your stride, you're going to exaggerate that. And every other drill is like that. And so drills are also really good neuromuscular activation. They help facilitate abs. They help facilitate the glute activation and so on. So that's the hard part. It's like you get deeper into this and it's a little bit more complicated than we realize. But having the range first and then having that, the activation of those muscles is really important.
Joe, thanks for all that. I have one question. Now that you have four additional letters after your name, do you have more letters in your name or after your name?
If you fully spell out my first and last name, it's probably pretty close. Yeah. We're at 10 at this point. Actually, we're at 12. So, yeah, we'll have to add my middle name in there to equal them out.
Do you get preferred parking over there at Ian's stable at his coaching place?
I hope so.
I don't know the last time you came to Ben, Joe.
In a while.
Hey, any closing comments before thumbs up, thumbs down on this topic, Matt or Ian?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that my little dirty secret of picking this topic is because I just want to hear Joe talk about it, and because I don't really know nearly as much about it as he does. So that was really good for me to hear. So I really appreciate that explanation, Joe. Thanks for that. I would maybe ask one sort of follow up question. Like runners in general, in terms of mobility, do we need less or more than the general, say, population or another typical type athlete? Because it certainly seems like a fair number of us are less mobile than, average. If you go to a yoga class, you can sort of pick out the runners.
Well, the yoga class would be an above average group in the population.
That's true, yeah.
Well, that question brings up one more thing that I'd like to interject before we move on, and that is, this is one of my favorite quotes that I believe I made up.
I hope it's your favorite.
Exactly. The best exercise is living well. Mm-hmm. And what that means is, if you are moving your body in an efficient way, you will automatically have optimal strength and optimal mobility to a point. And this is a very interesting idea and something I haven't written on yet, but it's the better, the more efficient you are, the easier yoga is. You're going to be naturally more flexible because you're not beating up your body, for one, and two, you're using the hip mobility, you're using the your body in such a way that it's moving well. And it's the same thing with strength. If you are efficient, you're going to have strong glutes and you're going to have strong abs. So it becomes this metric. It's like I go to a yoga class and I know how good my stride is based on how easy or how difficult yoga is. Hmm. And if it's tough and I'm really stiff, it's like, uh-oh, am I doing something I shouldn't be doing in the course of running? That said, I will say that to Matt's question, the one challenge is, especially for ultra runners, if you're training for Western States and you're like Ian and he's doing Black Butte Mountain up down repeats of 3,000 feet up and 3,000 down, you're going to accumulate stress and you're going to stiffen up. And so there is a challenge to kind of mitigate that. But at the end of the day, if you move well, once you get that ball rolling of moving well, it tends to, or run efficiently, you tend to have good mobility and good strength. And I think that's what put the top people in our sport tend to stay at the top because they can keep that going.
So perhaps on thumbs up, thumbs down, I think we're all thumbs up. We should do some strength. We should do some ability. I think that we'd all thumbs up. Let's put those two in order. What's most important, strength or mobility? And or you may want to answer, what do you think your clients need attention to the very most?
Well, that's how Matt worded the topic originally.
Oh, good.
Was strength or mobility, which is preferred?
Yeah, that's a great way to phrase it, Matt. I'm glad I caught on to that through the discussion. So let's start with Ian. What do you think, strength or mobility?
Well, based on what Joe was saying there, I think it's fair to say that without mobility, you can't really even run that much. So that's got to be more important. But if your mobility is already good, then you might get more benefit from the strength work. So I'd say it partly depends on where your starting point is.
Great. Matt?
I have to say that I can't say one or the other. Oh, man. Sorry about that.
It's your sandbox calling.
Yeah. And so I'm going to be in the middle. I'm going to sort of, you know, play just in the middle because it really depends.
Nice. The first sideways thumb. Good. I think we introduced that last time. So it's in the, we're able to choose that. Joe, your closing comment on which is more needed out there.
I mean, just to be logical, we'll say mobility first, right? Mm-hmm. Those guys, it's individualized based on what the runners need.
Very good.
What about you, Freeman?
Oh, you know what? I'm following their logic. I'm saying you've got to be mobile first and then strength second. If you had strength and no mobility, you'd be a statue.
Which are you the weakest in?
I'm equally weak at both.
Okay.
They can't even measure. They said no strength, no mobility, needs help. So we have a hard stop here, so we would have got about 15 minutes left.
Yep.
Okay, let's roll through this last one and keep it within that time frame.
This is also another topic that Matt came up with. Poles or no poles?
Ooh.
Poles or no poles? Let's talk about that.
Okay, who wants to start?
Let's go with Joe again, because this is a movement-based thing, certainly.
Well, this is a tough one, because this is the area where I have the least amount of both personal and coaching experience, I think, as opposed to Ian. But I think that If you think about, this is almost a different can of worms, but I think about what are the challenges biomechanically with ultra running, and so much of it has to do with how we can move or not move our body when we're trying to run up increasingly rugged or technical terrain. And how I see poles fitting into ultra running is when you have either a incline or a technical surface that's so severe, if poles can help you maintain good form, or at least, let's say, efficient posture, and if arms, let me back up and say, poles will allow you to connect your arms to your legs in a really advantageous way. And so even though I don't have the experience of using them or racing with them, they make biomechanical sense to me that if you can use them to maintain what would otherwise be your normal running stride, and as well as accentuate the ability to brake and control yourself, I think it's a great thing. But again, that's mostly theoretical on my part.
Yeah, let me throw this in there, and then you guys can use it if you want. I often wonder whether you lose your normal and preferred body mechanics by using the poles, where we know that we're efficient when we're torquing our torso and our hips and we're moving back and forth, and we don't skip a torque to our upper body and do two with the lower body. And I feel that happens sometimes with poles. If you're not matching arm stride for leg stride, you lose some of that. Any thought on losing biomechanics?
I want to make one comment, and then we'll shoot it over to Ian.
Yeah.
I would say that maybe your pole mechanics are not good.
Right. Well, that's what we're talking about. I want to hear.
So my point is if that's throwing off your stride, then maybe you need to work on some poling mechanics.
And I've done that. And yeah. I've tried to match, and I also noticed that there are times that I don't match. So let's let Ian weigh in on this.
Yeah, I mean, I've used them in a race once. I'm generally, I find they're not that useful, but I think it's a very personal thing. Mm. And I would say the main times that I've seen it work most for people is the longer the race is and the more rugged the race is. So as a kind of rule of thumb, I say if it's can take more than 24 hours and it's very mountainous, it's more useful typically as those things increase. So there's just been the Tour de Géant race in Italy, 220 miles, 80,000 feet of climbing. That's a race where I think pretty much everyone uses poles. So when it's that long, anything that can at least share the workload and save the legs a little bit because they're going to get so trashed, I think there's some benefit there, but you've certainly got to practice it. The other thing I'd say that it tends to help people more is if they have a skiing background. So they're very comfortable with using poles and it feels very natural to them. It's just an easier transition. And so you see that with, someone like Kilian Jornet or people who do ski mountaineering, who having poles in their hands is second nature. They do it 6 months a year and they've done it all their life. And they will tend to do it better than other people. But the one example I have for myself is doing the backside of Hope Pass in Leadville. So I've done that race 5 times. I've got 5 splits for doing that 2,500 foot, 2.5 mile climb, 20% gradient, and it's at high altitude. And all of those 5 times were within about 1.5 minutes. So almost exactly the same split every time, but the slowest one was the year I used poles. Hmm. So that told me that it certainly wasn't helping me. It didn't feel any easier. I did practice with them, but I could probably practice more. My efficiency with poles probably isn't amazing. But the simple thing for me there was that my legs weren't tired enough that I necessarily needed the poles to compensate. And that's why I'm saying if it's really, really long races, I think it's more helpful. But, it's very much a personal preference. Some people swear by them. Some people hate them. Some people use them uphill. Some people use them downhill as well on the technical stuff, especially when they're tired. So it's really something where someone's not going to know if it works unless they try it out. But it's good to maybe borrow a pair of poles rather than spending $100+ and then finding out you hate them.
How about you, Matt?
Well, I sort of felt like I was forced into using them because I was training for the CCC race in Europe, and I was living in Copenhagen, which is a very, very flat place. Mm. And so I wanted every advantage I could get to running up and also down. And the odd advantage I felt with them was actually the downhills. I didn't think I would use them downhill, but like Ian alluded to, at the end of the race when I was tired and it was dark and it was raining and it was slippery, I caught myself on more than one occasion with the poles. Mm. And that was really helpful, I found, to just staying on my feet and like not being as tentative while I was descending. So I think that there's definitely advantages to using them. And I encourage people to try them out and to try to get used to them. And it just makes sense, like biomechanically, the way Joe worded it, that if you are continuing your like just helping your legs a little bit, that it seems like it would be a benefit in the long run. I always get smoked by the Europeans on the downhill, so they must be doing something right. Yeah.
What are your opinions, before we get to the thumbs up and thumbs down vote, what are your opinions on races that don't allow poles? Should they be allowed if someone feels that it's the best choice for them? Should they have the ability to use them if they want?
I like races where they're banned because then you don't get poked in the eye. And actually the races where they're allowed are typically the really big European races where the trail is very congested. So you get the conga line of people, and because it's steep, as they swing back, it is at exactly your eye level. So I've had some near misses there I much prefer races that don't allow poles because I don't want to use them anyway. Mm-hmm. And I'd rather not be potentially injured by someone else's poles.
How about you, Joe?
That's interesting. I feel like we might be a little bit biased being relatively in the front of the pack in maybe not wanting to use poles. And so I think of it, if poles allow somebody to stay safe, and if they allow somebody to maintain forward posture, which I think is a huge challenge when you're running downhill, to not back lean, if you could have something that's going to like help you feel more comfortable on technical terrain, I kind of like them. If that's going to help bridge the gap to teach somebody to become a better technical runner and more confident on a downhill, I think that that's a good thing. But I do think that there needs to be some limitation in terms of the events in which they're used, because if there isn't technicality, then I just don't think that they're necessary.
But one question, Joe, what about when you've got a technical downhill and so you have the coordination of using your feet well, but then the poles are an additional skill, obviously, that needs to be learned. But I've heard from people both sides where they say they find they can go quicker without the poles, but maybe it helps if their legs are really fatigued. But just from a skill perspective, when it's only 2 feet you've got to deal with, you can kind of maybe be a little bit more agile with that. And so it might help if you're tired or really tired, but that you might go slower. Do you have an opinion on that in terms of just it being an additional point you have to put on the ground, another kind of, not just skill, but another thing that can slow you down instead of just kind of skipping over the top of technical terrain?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's highly individualized, and perhaps the best use of poles is almost like prophylactically, where you're not striking the ground until you need it. Maybe it's not until you round a corner or until you get to a money spot where that pole might actually come into contact. Otherwise, it's just an extension of your arm, I guess.
I may have mentioned this before on the podcast, but I skied quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And what Joe said is absolutely right. When you're going downhill skiing, you don't use the pole in a hard way where you're hitting the ground. It's more of a tap or a touch. And as I was coaching skiing, it's more of having an extension to your arm. If you think of a tightrope walker where they have the pole that they use, it helps with balance. So it may just be that a little bit of a balance thing, and you don't want to rely on the poles, especially as you're going downhill. We're talking downhill. As you're going downhill, you don't want to rely on those poles. You're using those more as a balance. And then, like Matt said, if there is a mishap in your balance where you start to go down, to catch yourself. But anyway, that's my input there.
I've got a comment. As we look at all the Europeans using poles, and I know their mountains are a bit different than ours, maybe not Colorado, but they have some rugged terrain out there. We talked about the path of least resistance. The human body finds the easiest way. It seems like if they didn't work, there wouldn't be so many Europeans carrying them. I've got to just think they're voting by their feet or what's in their hands. They're probably pretty efficient. Once we do all the studies and all the science and crunch the numbers, we've probably figured it out just by looking at the population of runners.
Some of those Europeans are using poles as schnapps carriers.
They may. They may need. Hey, let's get a thumbs up and thumbs down on poles, and then let's get these guys back to their sandboxes that spend their time in during the day.
Matt, it was your topic. You get a first vote.
Well, I just want to say, when Joe said, you know, that the front of the pack doesn't use poles, I think he was basically calling me slow.
Yeah.
but I'm still going thumbs up. I think that they can be really useful as an adjunct to help your legs get up and also down the mountain. So,
well, Matt, if you're slow, that's not good for Scott or I.
Yeah.
Ian, thumbs up, thumbs down on poles.
I'd actually say at the front of the pack in these big races, I was just out at UTMB, you get some who use poles, some who don't. So It's probably nearer the back of the pack that it's more ubiquitous, that everyone's using them. I would say they must have a benefit, but I personally don't like them. And I think for especially below 100 miles, they're less useful. So I'm going to go in the middle there.
Ah, the second sideways thumb. Joe?
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up. Okay. Thumbs up. I'm definitely thumbs up. Oh, I love those poles. They feel like I'm cheating. It's like I'm running on four limbs instead of two. I like them.
And as I'm representing the back of the pack, I also will give it a thumbs up. I, coming from a ski background, they seem very natural to me. I feel like I'm a better runner when I have them in my hands, whether they're touching the ground or not. So, hey guys, thank you very much. This is a very helpful, great discussion.
A lot of good topics. So Thanks, Matt, for sending those over.
Yeah, we need to make sure we do this more frequently, because this is good stuff. We actually have more topics that we could go into if we had a little more time. You can learn more from Joe at yuhanperformance.com. He's a coach over there. Ian, of course, runs Charmin Ultra, charminultra.com, and Matt is now part of that team. Matt's also an assistant professor of health and human performance over at the College of Idaho. You can see all three of them in Ultra Running Magazine. They all three have written, I think, are currently on contract retainer to write for Ultra Running Magazine.
Yeah, Carl's got them under tight contract.
And usually very, very interesting articles they come up with. So, hey, guys, thank you very much, and we appreciate your thumbs.
Thank you.
Go out and thumb
Moss.